Our second panelist is Bonnie Cassidy. She's titled her presentation Unbidden, although I have to ask if it should be voiced twice from its. But, Paul, I'm good. I'm good.
No, I just, I've got a problem with colons, or punctuation mark at least. So it's just a sort of more poetic title than an explicatory one. I'd like to echo Matt's acknowledgement of the traditional owners of the country that we're meeting on. And I must also begin with a warning that this paper contains references to and descriptions of deceased Aboriginal persons, specifically the Noongar warrior Yagan. Influenced and shaped by some 50 years of Indigenous poetry in English and in published text, the last couple of decades of Australian settler poetry have advanced prolific attempts to write oneself into the country, producing varied and sometimes radical poetries of regionality, topography, climate, and the histories, narratives, and landmarks running through and over them. I contend that such contemporary work by settler poets is a continuum of varyingly compelling attempts to write in the presence not only of Indigenous poetry, but also of colonisation's ongoing effects and of unceded Indigenous sovereignty. Examples of such poetry may be post-colonial and may indeed envision decolonisation, where, to use Bob Hodge and Vijay Mishra's terms, they seek to annul, diffuse, displace and negate the intractable conditions of the foundation event of Australia's colonial history. To me, John Mateer's so-called Australian poems of the 1990s and the 2000s offer some of the most powerful expressions of this intention or this potential. They are also some of the most vexed. This paper focuses upon the localised impact of a poem, one poem by John Mateer, but it does so with the intention of opening it to a wider discussion of post-colonial poetics. I'm interested in how the views and questions within this paper might invite connections with North American frames of reference and how in John Mateer's poetics illuminate the contemporary practice and critique of Australian poetry by both settlers and Indigenous writers. John Mateer's preoccupation with the ontological predicament of being in Australia is one shared with numerous contemporary poets, and I would include myself among them. What is particularly original about his so-called Australian poems is how they construct a settler's understanding of place, in his own words, to write a poetry that imagines the trauma of this place, to be a poet who could express mourning and resistance of language in a landscape so populated with irony, comes up from earlier, that it hardly seems connected to the earth, in wanting to imagine the spirit of place. Mateer's desire to resist irony pushes against a local tradition entrenched in literature, cinema, and other cultural media of self-denigration that portrays Australian settlers as morally or spiritually deficient. In his moving study, Belonging, Australians' Place and Aboriginal Ownership, Peter Reid argues for settlers to reassess this tradition in order to move beyond colonial narratives of settlement. As John Mateer asserts, his poetry seeks to undertake this work of reassessment by imagining what he calls the spirit of place. Australian eco-philosophers such as David Tacey, Val Plumwood and Veronica Brady have explored the meaning of spirit to non-Indigenous encounters with place. But what does this term or this phrase mean within the context of Mateer's poetry? How does his sense of the spirit of place approach a history of trauma, mourning and resistance? One example might be a poem called A Coastal Walk-Up from Augusta, a very short poem in Mateer's 2002 collection called Loan Words. Here the speaker walks with a knowledge of the past and a consciousness of the present, and this intersection allows them to imagine a place beyond individual ontology. Set at Augusta on the southwest coast of Western Australia, the poem dwells within the country of the Noongar people. Trudging across an inlet with the winter tide rushing in, my boots slurping the sand, the water detonating, then foaming and fanning over the hump of beach. Over my boots, the cold surface bubbling forever, in an instant like trillions of equidistant molecules between which this was annihilated. The verbs detonating and annihilated ring out as allusions to militaristic and genocidal violence such as that committed against the Noongar. Their referent, the white water, metaphorically links the violence to the speaker's body and its moment in time. As the foam fans over beach and boots, the ocean seems to treat the speaker as continuous with the ground, connected to the earth. Now aware of this physical continuity, Matthias Speaker observes the destruction of the subjective present, this, into an equidistant relationship with more than himself. Tidal and temporary, however, this empathetic moment is gone almost as soon as it is imagined. It seems to pop or burst. I would argue that this fleeting collective consciousness, albeit imaginary, constitutes what Mattia names a spirit of place. I think this is what he's trying to describe with that phrase. And in this sense of the term, spirit of place may be distinguished from spiritual identification with place. The poem shows spirit of place to be more like a current across time and across bodies. And moreover, that current springs from an historicised perception of place, one that seems hyper-aware of how the priority of Indigenous sovereignty might be acknowledged and met with in the poetic space. Marcy Langton writes of, quote, a distinctive Australian settler voice that speaks of a deepening attachment to place and locality as the core of identity. Aboriginal attachment to places inherited from many generations of ancestors and shaped by kinship, descent, culture and religion does not preclude settlers from engaging with the land they love, end quote. As a deliberate act of imagining, Mattia's poem enacts its connection to the earth of Augusta without irony, yet clearly distinguishes that connection from kinship, descent, culture and religion. In this brief poem, Mattia intimates an empathetic imaginary continuity with the topography of Augusta, and in doing so with Noongar suffering. Yet it represents no more than a moment's realisation, and this brevity shows humility and sensitivity. A coastal walk up from Augusta seems to rest lightly upon its location, acknowledging a history of trauma and resistance as a part of knowing the place. By momentarily effacing the speaker's subjectivity, the poem eschews a claim of ownership to the land it inhabits. This reflects Peter Reid's suggestion to Australian settlers that, quote, we have to stop thinking in terms of the self-justicatory discourse of the coloniser, who seems to have refined the principle of individual ownership of land in order to sidestep Indigenous people who may not so limit themselves. In this sense, I think the poem offers a compelling realisation of Stuart Cook's challenge to post-colonial poetics. Stuart says, we are not rooted in a location, relentlessly sucking up groundwater. We are rather speakers of matter, always communicating the transformation of energies across multiple subjectivities. It's time to place a limit on the first-person voice, to stop pretending that the best way to experience the world is by wandering through it alone. Interestingly, while many of Mattia's Australian poems are carried by the solitary speaking subject, I think the poem A Coastal Walk Up from Augusta demonstrates how he uses this subjectivity precisely to complicate and thus resist its colonising tradition. So I'm saying that he subverts the idea of the romantic solitary wanderer or walker. The poem may be an example of what Nicholas Burns calls the affect of concern in 21st century Australian writing, which he describes as political altruism ramified by the acknowledgement of affect. It is an awakening not just to political inequality, but to interpersonal feeling. Many more of Mattia's Australian poems explore this use of voice and image. In their hyper-awareness of the poet's whiteness, they may be thought of as intentionally practicing effects of what Michael Farrell has called and practiced as unsettlement, the way a text construction may be seen to destabilise normative expressions of settlement, making a material negation or resistance to those. Yes, but. In the presence of constitutional unrecognition of Indigenous sovereignty, in the presence of colonisation, and in the presence of Indigenous literature, how much destabilisation of the settler subject will the poem allow, and will readers and writers allow the poem? How does the settler poet make creative decisions about how to represent their own spirit of place? In John Kinsella's words, What is and is not available to the poet in creating a poetic language that carries its own intactness and its own implications for reading? After all, as Peter Reid reminds the settler, we cannot share the land with Aboriginal people until they have their land to share with us. We cannot fully belong in our own culturally specific fashion if that fashion excludes others from belonging within their own cultures. So a much longer poem from the book Loan Words is one called In the Presence of a Severed Head. And I think it's a flashpoint in recent settler poetry's attempts to address this impasse. In the collection Loan Words from 2002, it was published with subtitles in Noongar. A year later, in 2003, and many people will have read accounts of this event before, I'm not pretending like I'm describing it for the first time, but for those who aren't aware of it, this is a sort of gloss of a particular event. So a year later, after the publication of the original version of In the Presence of a Severed Head, John Mattia and the Indigenous Australian novelist Kim Scott met at the Fremantle Arts Centre for a public reading. Mattia's contribution to the event was his poetry cycle In the Presence of a Severed Head, in which he addresses Yagan, a Noongar warrior who was killed in 1833, after which his head was cut off, smoked in a tree stump and taken to England to be exhibited. Scott, according to Mattia, was visibly agitated after listening to the reading and explained that he felt there should be a moratorium on non-Aboriginal people writing on blackfellow culture. In his 2005 book, Kayang and Me, Scott himself wrote about the incident, calling Mattia a stranger and a recent arrival who had no right to address Scott's Noongar heritage. Kim Scott writes in Kayang and Me that he found the poem discomforting, quote, mainly because of its Noongar language and concepts as recorded by various colonial authorities, particularly the poem's notion of Noongar reincarnation, a concept that Scott has represented in his award-winning novel, That Dead Man Dance. 8 years later, Mattia amended the sequence for republication in his selected poems called The West. So he removed the Noongar language from the poem and he retitled it In the Presence, 15 Songs. In each song or canto of the cycle, the speaker incants the name of Yagan. I'm just going to read a few sections of the 15 parts. Here was one. Yagan. Even if I stab a bloody cum tree, you will not speak. Yagan. The tree doesn't say, once I married the earth to the sky, and its branches don't say, once we sang with the wind. The ghosts of the spoken of this huge tree on which every leaf is a silence language. The leaves don't mutter in passing, falling, we are not regret, we are nutrients slowly releasing. Nor does the bark respond. The strips are scarified, flayed, shredded document. The poem takes Yagan's killing at the Swan River colony as the apotheosis of the violent colonisation of continuous Noongar culture. The gum tree or eucalypt stands as a repository of the culture and language that give it voice and meaning. The poem's opening introduces a note of negation, contradicting lyrical conciliation and expressing an unquenchable hollowness. Even if I stab a bloody gum tree, the theft will not be redeemed. Yet Mattia's incantation attempts to call back the dead warrior as a source of energy and healing, not only to the Noongar perhaps, but to the poet's community, Perth, Southwest Australia, perhaps the nation. In doing so, the poem links the historical event of Yagan's death to the later context of the poem's composition, which was the British repatriation of Yagan's remains in 1997. Another section from the poem, which I won't read, I'll just leave you to have a look at here. In an affect of concern, the poem wants to make itself a space in which the repatriation of the warrior's remains and the state's rhetoric of reconciliation can be made true. Mattia himself describes the poem's redemptive hope that his poetics, quote, could be answered with the beginning of a real dialogue, the only way of creating poetics in Australia, end quote. Framed as a plea or incantation, however, the poem implies its own unrealised possibility. This is comparable to the fragile moment within A Coastal Walk-Up from Augusta. The critic Michael Heald explains, to resist and transform the worldview and language of the oppressor and mutilator, to be put back together in a bodily and spiritual sense, to achieve a public hearing which makes a difference, to restore a comprehensive historical perspective, is such a nexus of aspiration and frustration that we find as the complex and highly charged act of talking with Jagan's head. The tone of the poem's speaker is ambiguous and shifting. It can turn from deflated to resentful to rapturous. Similarly, Mateer moves on from irony to an authentic range of affective concern. Jen Crawford has written that the poem seeks not resolution but a greater challenge in the Australian context, an unhalting conversational current of social and environmental perception. In both the poems I've mentioned, Mateer seeks to construct a position suspended within that current of histories and subjectivities. With this poem, however, the poet's desire to unsettle his own presence achieved the opposite effect. In assuming poetic access to the public figure of Jagan, part of a shared history of place, a spirit of place, Mateer also went further, slipping perhaps into assumptions of language and belief, an erroneous assumption of shared heritage, shared ownership. In his memoir, Kayang and Me, Kim Scott expresses how isolated and disenfranchised he felt by the poem. Scott himself had only recently, as an adult, found access to learning his language and retrieving his Noongar heritage. In Mateer's accounts of the event, Scott called out the illegitimacy of Mateer's access to Noongar belief and language. He recounted the story of a woman who, in burying her father, felt she wished to destroy all the documents that he'd been gathering on their culture, so that the white bastards wouldn't get that too. As well as removing the language from his revised version of the poem, Mateer placed the word reincarnation in inverted commas, highlighting a doubly borrowed concept this time around, borrowed once by colonial records and secondly by the settler poet. Jagan, avatar, you are that moment of déjà vu when in the early days of settlement your people embraced not the invaders but the ancestors returning in their ghostly skin. Jagan, even you were reincarnated, a white man, once. Mateer also added a warning to Indigenous readers, signalling that he had come to understand the possible distress inherent in the violent and linguistic treatment of the warrior's body. And he made a final revision in his later version of In the Presence. He added an envoy, since Jagan's head had now been given a traditional burial ceremony. So the later envoy reads, "In the dusk, in King's Park, I'm running. The hero's remains will be returned tomorrow. Seeing ahead of me through the silent bushland of skin, that severed head glowing, lighting this path." The path, of course, is not simply in the locale of King's Park, but also the poem itself, the poetic way through a place. Jagan's head is figured as a beacon that directs the poet. The poet feels himself drawn into an excited intimacy with the resistance hero, his avatar. Jagan is embodied, not absent. He is appearing, and the living skin of the bushland might be redeemed tomorrow. As Nicholas Burns explains, the literary affect of concern, quote, is a myth rather than a doctrine. It is speculative more than it is polemical, fostering a hope for something not currently true, but which the writer hopes to make true. This is precisely why the imagination is needed. The poem's opening lines of negation suggest the impasse that Mateer wants to cross, and the poem, while sparse in form, overflows it. I'm wondering if this is the threshold event that Peter Minter invokes in his examples of proliferation, but I'm not sure at all, and I still need to think about that idea of the threshold event further. Michael Heald notes that this is not the poetry of the silent communion with the page. It is actual speech trying to make a place for itself in the public domain, episodes which we might ordinarily consider private or even taboo. John Kinsella, who sympathises with the so-called maverick poetics of John Mateer, contrasts Mateer's framing of Noongar language with the overtly appropriative or worse tendencies of a movement like Jindy Warrabax, which Toby mentioned this morning. Kinsella argues that whereas the latter movement practised an Aboriginalism that asserted rights of ownership in the intellectual and cultural sphere to match power in the political and economic sphere, Mateer does not try to eclipse Aboriginal expressions of identity. This is Kinsella's argument. He says, Scott's isolating of Mateer's South African origins does not take into consideration the fact that Mateer is both poetically and in terms of self-identity, as much a part of Western Australia as of his land of birth. Mattia, in Loanwords, utilises borrowings and usages from a number of languages in order to reconstitute their original implications, while also building in the agency of new meaning in a language in which they are deployed. This transnationality is the main driver of his work. End quote. But Mattia's revisions did not heal his sense of having been misunderstood, nor did the fact that Kim Scott later praised other elements of the poem. For Mattia, the encounter with Scott was mostly responsible for leading to 10 years of silence about the event and ultimately a deliberate turning away from writing further Australian poems. In 2012, Mattia reflected on this decision in an essay titled Nativism and the Interlocutor, published in Cordite Poetry Review by Matthew Hall and Kent McCarter. He describes how in this period he had, quote, completely effaced that work from his memory, that this erasure, this forgetting, had been so successful, filled him with an anxiety, his own moratorium, end quote. Mattia didn't see himself as a stranger to his place of settlement or to knowledge of Noongar sovereignty and colonisation, but nor, it would seem, could he comprehend or accept that the poem failed to contain the complexities he intended. This confusion, this bafflement, creates its own impasse. Mattia has determinedly steered the past decade of his work away from directly addressing this issue, yet whilst pursuing themes of whiteness, cultural migration and legitimacy in relation to other places and their histories. Paradoxically, an attack of white guilt has shut off Mattia's further poetic attention to the ontological problem of being in Australia and specifically to his own place there. The successes and failures of this poem in the presence stimulate our reading of an already active culture of post-colonial Australian poetics, in which a political, social and economic state of decolonisation may be imagined. At a very brief glance, settler poets including Michael Farrell, Peter Minto, Stuart Cook, Laurie Duggan, Jill Jones, Nick Wittick, Martin Harrison, O.A. New, Duncan Hose, Meredith Watterson, Louise Crisp, Matthew Hall, and many more, unsettle normative and centralised settler narratives of place. By comparison, Mattia's poems try to break down whiteness whilst maintaining the legitimacy of his own voice to identify with the place. They also knowingly call our attention to this friction. It's his struggle to find or not find a poetic pathway through this problem which interests me. It's how this instance raises questions for settler poets about how they creatively advance ways of thinking through and representing belonging and shared history in the full presence of colonisation and Indigenous sovereignty. To write about a place in such a way that is at once loving and questioning, to somehow hang above the ground. Unlike John Kinsella, I'm surprised by Mattia's inability to anticipate some of the particular problems with his first version of the sequence. The use of a colonised language by a non-speaker would seem to be one of the more clear-cut issues of cultural appropriation, with its specific resonance of language theft and erasure. Mattia says that he spoke to many, many people about the composition of his Australian poems, but I wonder if the protocols of permission and consultation help us to clarify the questions that are raised by In the Presence and the conversation that follows on from it. Because less clear in terms of lawfulness is Mattia's extension of imagining a spirit of place, moving from the settler's brief communion with a shared colonial history to the literalised address of a revenant, the assumption of that figure as part of the settler's living reality. It may be an important example in both its voice of concern and its flaws of vision. In her essay, Settled and Unsettled Spaces, Are We Free to Roam?, Professor of Law Irene Watson reflects this poetic problem. She asks, can we move from places where whitefellas feel truly uncomfortable into what I call a meditation on discomfort, to places where the settler society is made to answer these questions? What brings them to a state of lawfulness, or how lawful is their sovereign status? This suggests to me a careful and honest practice of creating a poetic space in which the settler voice is present yet suspended, speaking about country with a sense of unlawful time and place. Much of the poem In the Presence achieves this meditation through motifs of absence and negation, set against its anaphoric energy and the proud tone of its envoy. And yet its taboo nature is the disturbingly comfortable, lawful way in which Mattia's poem goes about its intention, the boldness of how its poetic voice and vision inhabit Noongar heritage and country. How might the complex problems of In the Presence illuminate other poets' attempts to destabilise colonial relationships between dwelling, ownership and identity. Stuart Cook describes the potential of post-colonial Australian poetics. He imagines enriched, stimulating metaphors in which the elements of physical matter and their manifestation as speech produce via the imagination startling works of art. We might see the emergence of radical new articulations of Australian locales, replete with new sounds and grammars, and new linkages made between previously discrete parts, including a process of integrating the speaker's own biology into a hitherto strange or elusive environment and history. The poem In the Presence advances a representation of environment and history as being inextricably linked for both the settler and the traditional owner. For Matthias Settler, the experience of place dwells somewhere between self-doubt and legitimacy. This position reflects how Hodge and Mishra have highlighted legitimacy as crucial in the Australian definition of identity, yet constituted by a shared sense of illegitimacy. But by invoking a spirit of place, I think Matthias attempts to move beyond this ironic irresolution. He sees poetic form and voice as ways to force the present moment out of itself. He wants the poem to be one of action, rather perhaps than of witness or of activism. Matthias was right to revise the earlier poem, I think, but not to fall into silence on its issues of concern. It is a question of how. For the settler poet, to depart from the presence of one's privilege or one's illegitimacy seems to me to give up on a fundamental critical tool for post-colonial poetics, let alone on a vision of decolonisation.